Hello and welcome back to the Future Work Life podcast. My name is Ollie Henderson and I've got a return guest today. It's Isabel Berwick, host of the FT's award-winning Working It podcast, co-writer of the weekly Working It newsletter, and now the author of The Future Proof Career, which is published this week. The book covers a wide range of topics, everything from the four-day working week, bridging the workplace generation gap, trends we've seen over the past few years like quiet quitting and the great resignation. And all in all, it's written to help us all understand the modern workplace, to have happier, more productive lives. This was another brilliant conversation with Isabel. I always really enjoy chatting with her. And we talked about some of the things I just mentioned, as well as big themes like the pressure on the modern manager, why power skills like communication and creativity will remain critical as AI becomes a part of everyday working life. And we also discuss why late career blooming is both a thing and something to look forward to. So if you want to pick up a copy of Isabel's book, you'll find a link in the show notes. Also check out the Working It podcast and newsletter. And if you'd like me to come and speak to you and your team about the themes we cover in this podcast, you can also find a link in the show notes to get in touch. So let's jump into my conversation with Isabel Berwick. Isabel, it's great to have you back on the podcast. I'm going to dig into quite a lot of the themes that you talk about in your new book, but I want to understand first why understanding your own ambition is crucial for career success.
Oh, I think that is something that I've come to rather too late, but I think it's very easy to have a sort of scattergun approach to our career or take the paths that are suggested to us. You know, we might be offered a promotion internally and be flattered and want to please our boss, but actually, is that the right thing for us? And I think people are starting to take more of a step back now and look at it from a personal point of view and a long-term point of view, rather than how can I best serve my employer?
Yeah, and actually one immediate thing that jumps to me when I think about this is the idea that the only way to progress within a company is as a manager. And there's definitely talk at the moment about, can we create more just subject matter specialists, I suppose, where you're just excellent at a job and there's an opportunity to progress and get senior and get paid more money just for being really, really bloody good at that job?
Yeah, I mean, that started in the tech industry, didn't it? And I think it is spreading out. I mean, I think we've got an episode this week actually about can you succeed without being a manager? And the answer, I think, still is yes, but in a lot of organizations. So it requires a bit of vision to promote people who aren't managers, or exactly to really value that, excuse me, specialism. But I really hope that's changing. It sounds like it is.
And you've split your book into two parts, essentially, haven't you? One for employees. Although workers, again, is a phrase people use, because employees is one categorization, but you could, I guess, be a long-term contractor or various other things. But you split it essentially into employees and managers. So what was the thinking there? Is that just a reflection of the existing kind of world, this existing paradigm that you do tend to progress into management?
Yeah. I mean, it's more a reflection of most people's lives. And I take your point about employees. I mean, maybe we could have put workers or staff, but most people are in a team or are a team member if you're in a sort of corporate or an organizational structure. And some people are also managers. So we're often both. But I think when you're a manager, there are particular ways you have to relate to other people above and below you that are specific to that. So that's kind of why I split it. But it is I can't pretend it's a book for everybody. It is really a book about how to make work decent and how to thrive if you're really in any sort of organizational corporate structure.
And the title, I guess you could read it two ways as well. Of course, we're always thinking about, for example, you know, skills. How do we make sure that we have the right skills to be able to exist in this fast evolving technological world? But actually, I think a future-proof career starts with, as we discuss right at the very beginning, understanding what you want from your career, doesn't it? The future of your career depends on how you want to shape it.
Yeah, and it sort of evolved as I was writing the book. I realized that this is a very human-centered book. Although obviously I talk about AI, it's quite hard to talk about AI in any meaningful way, because by the time, you know, this hopefully goes into a second edition, it might all be redundant. So I've been quite circumspect about that, but I don't know if you agree, Ollie. I think the skills that we really need to focus on and that we can control are the human skills and the way that we relate to others.
And actually, it's those human skills become even more important, I think, as automation and machine learning take control of some of the parts of our job which we might have seen to be a little bit more mundane. So I 100% agree. In fact, I like the idea that we don't talk about soft skills anymore, that there's some better way of saying it. And power skills is one idea. I like power skills. That's the one I generally
I like power skills, yes, because soft skills really, I suppose, is a reflection of the time, isn't it, when that was in the business school parlance, it was denigrated or not really taught. I mean, I've got a stat in the book about how little listening is taught or was taught in business schools as a skill because it wasn't considered relevant. Whereas now listening has become a hugely important skill. Even if it's talked about, even if it's not very well practiced yet.
Mm. Have you become a better listener throughout your career?
Oh, God, I'm trying. No, I think I'm a terrible listener, but I've actually started to be a lot more thoughtful about it. So I now know how terrible I am. And that's almost the worst point, isn't it? When you have the blind spot, it's kind of you troll along quite happily. But now I'm really trying hard to listen better. And it's really hard. As someone said to me, you know, everyone wants to be heard, but no one wants to listen, which I think is one of the central dilemmas in workplaces at the moment.
I always thought I was quite a good listener. And then I interviewed Matt Abrahams, who you referenced in your book. And we had a really great conversation. But I was left at the end of it, which I did say to him, thinking, I've got so much to do to improve my communication skills. Clearly, look, this is the guy's job. He spent 25 years teaching communication at Stanford, so you'd hope he'd be pretty good at it. But I really did feel like he was listening to me, and that definitely is a skill, to sort of get that sense that the person you're communicating with is really taking on board everything you're saying, responding to it, not doing what most of us do, let's be honest, which is thinking ahead to the next thing we're going to say. Yeah, it's really
tricky.
I couldn't
agree more, Ollie.
Yeah.
See what I did there.
Like it. So, I mean, various things we can talk about. One of the interesting ones, I think, at the moment, which I think particularly maybe because it's a challenging economic climate, and certainly I work in and around a lot of tech businesses, and there's been lots of layoffs, and the consequence of that is often low morale, but a feeling that in some cases, a toxic atmosphere, toxic workplaces are a challenge. How do you spot whether there's toxicity in your organization, or on the flip side, what you describe as a healthy organization? How do you spot those characteristics either before you join it or even when you're employed by them?
It's quite hard before you join, and that's a real pitfall of moving jobs. And I talk about that a bit in the book, but there are things you can do. You know, you can go on social media, you can ask friends of friends, you can activate your LinkedIn network just to try and find out a little bit about what's going on or what the reality is. But I think when you're there, I suppose the best thing I distilled was look at the top. You know, are the people at the top modelling a healthy workplace? And by that, I don't just mean the way that people get on with each other, but actually physical and mental health. You know, is everyone overworking? Do the bosses send emails at all hours of the day and night? And is there a presumption that you should too? You know, I think this old-fashioned idea of the CEO and the senior executives working 70, 80-hour weeks is still there, but what we don't see is the flip side, that loads of them are going to these very expensive secret retreats for their exhaustion. And you know, there's a whole industry that's sprung up to help CEOs not to fall over. And the dark underbelly of the toxic workplace, I think, is that. And until we all are a bit more honest about our limitations, it'll probably continue. But I mean, as an individual, what can you do? It's limited. And I think, and I don't know if you agree, but our experience of work is generally limited to our team and our line manager. It's great if our ideas are aligned with the purpose of the company and all that stuff. But actually, our day-to-day, do we like the people we work with? Is our manager a decent human being who treats us well and we enjoy their company? I mean, managers are the sort of linchpin in everything.
Yeah, Gallup's data is always really interesting on this. It shows a hugely disproportionate impact of your line manager, essentially, on your engagement with that business. And engagement's a bit of a tricky one, but essentially, whether you feel like you're being challenged, like your work's being recognized, like you're feeling like you can grow within the organization, all those things fundamentally, which most people value in a job, and also being treated with respect, because that's the other thing. You'd think that was table stakes, wouldn't you? But it's not necessarily in some companies. But I suppose the thing is with managers, and this has been my experience when I've worked with bigger organizations, That's true. And you can have someone with the best intentions as a manager, but if they've got a terrible boss, it can cascade. So their experience of work, they might be trying their best to allow you the opportunity to, you know, make your work visible and make sure they recognize your contribution. But if they're getting crap rolling downhill from their boss, it can make it really, really difficult. So I suppose that's where the impact of senior leadership can flow down and have a negative impact.
Yeah, I mean, the position of the team leader or middle manager is not, you know, the filling and the sandwich is not an enviable place to be, is it?
No. Do you think that's got more difficult over the past couple of years? Because certainly the feeling I get, and you look at some of the survey data, there's self-reported data from managers is that they don't necessarily feel like they've got the skills to manage these more complex work modes, by which it typically means people working in different locations at different times. Has that been what you've seen as well from the research you've done for the book? Is that reflected?
Yeah, and I think if we say anecdotally, but I think it is also reflected in things like Gallup surveys and Slack or some Microsoft also do big surveys. I mean, one of the big key issues for managers is exactly that burnout for themselves. Mm. And I think the thing that flipped in the pandemic was having to be a therapist as well as a manager. And most people are not therapists. And that's when you combine the pandemic and different ways of working with the new demographics coming through. So Gen Z have a much higher expectation of what their managers will do for them. They're much more open about their mental health issues and they expect them to be listened to and addressed. So all of that is piling more burden onto a manager who might be in their late 30s, 40s or 50s and probably hasn't been taught those skills. So I think forward-looking companies are thinking about how to equip managers with the right skills. But actually, there does come a point where you think, should the pastoral care type of aspect of management be moved away into you know, in-house counsellors, which is another growth area. So I think that might be something. I think managers can't go on. The burnout is real. And I think the solution might be more structured support for staff in their personal lives. And then you've got managers who are just taking care of business, as it were. I could be wrong, but something's got to give.
Well, it relates to that point you mentioned at the beginning, which is that there shouldn't only be one route to progress through a company. And likewise, the manager's role shouldn't be to have to wear different, you know, 20 different hats, should it? There's something in being a manager of people and even having been exceptional at that job and therefore understand the intricacies of what someone's doing day to day. I mean, look, if you've done that, which I know you have and I have, where you've been good at a role, you've been promoted into becoming a manager, and it does help that you understand what that person's going through. So absolutely, that's valuable. But yeah, add on to that life coach or career coach and then add on to that therapist and various other things, and it quickly becomes unmanageable even if you do get the right training. What about productivity? Because that, again, if you think about toxicity or the message coming from the top, the probably easiest headline to think of is return to office, it improves productivity, which I take as code for we don't know who's delivering value and how to measure it.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't deliver productivity, does it? I mean, the return to office narrative is, if they're honest that they want to see people sitting at their desk because it makes them feel better about themselves, that's fine. But it isn't that isn't really what it's about, is it? And I think the productivity conundrum is fascinating. And that I've just read that new Cal Newport book, Slow Productivity. And one of the central ideas in that, which I, to my shame, hadn't thought about before, is that in knowledge work, there is no definition of, you know, productivity. There's no end to what we do. I mean, in a sense, in newspapers, we're lucky because there is an output. So in the olden days, we put a paper out. I mean, now it's a bit more, you know, the website can have an infinite amount of stuff on it. But we do have jobs with a defined output generally. But I mean, for a lot of knowledge work and consulting and law, you know, it's how long is a piece of string, really? And you can just keep going. And that's how these jobs become greedy jobs, as it were. And I think Cal Newport's encouraging us to think again about what we mean by productivity. And I think it's a bit, goes back to a bit also what Oliver Berkman talks about in his book, 4,000 Weeks. Just let's just be reasonable about what a human being can achieve. I think that's got a bit out of control, aided by tech. If you're all, you know, the kind of the Slack and Asanas of these worlds seem to make things easier, but actually it's just piling on the list of to do, isn't it?
Yeah. I haven't actually read Cal Newport's new book yet. Ironically, I haven't made time for it. But Nick Bloom, I spoke to recently, who is the remote work expert. He's at Stanford Work From Home Institute, I think his company's called. And he was talking about productivity. And I was asking him, like, how does an organization actually define it? Because in pure economic terms, we're not talking about productivity, you know. And so he had done some research which was looking at comparative output from sales and marketing teams, for example. But again, if you drill down deep within sales teams, I guess you can relatively easily benchmark performance. Certainly there's sales targets often set, and you can usually compare one salesperson to another and see, relatively speaking, whether they're closing the same amount of revenue, booking the same numbers of meetings. But as you said, I mean, almost every role within an organization, it's really, really, really difficult to define that. And I think that's why we talk about visibility, and you wrote about visibility in the book as well, which is just a subject I'm fascinated by, because, you know, in the same way that making great work visible is often reduced to the loudest voice in the room. If you've in close proximity to your boss, or if you just happen to have a loud voice in a meeting, you can make it really clear that you're doing a good job. And actually, again, the vast majority of people don't work like that, and therefore their work's not made visible. So actually solving that problem of understanding what people are doing and making sure everybody's work is visible is probably one of the biggest challenges that we've got in the workplace.
But it requires some sort of quite in-depth thinking, because another word for that is productivity theatre, that I quite like. You know, the people who are engaging in productivity theatre, showing that they're on Slack, you know, speaking up in the meetings, being very vocal. I mean, it's a rational way to behave in the office. It's a rational way to behave in an imperfect organisational structure. But how, I suppose the bigger question is, how do the people who are not naturally inclined that way sort themselves out? I think I've tried to address that a little bit in the book. But I think, and I'm being a bit gendered here, but particularly for women, that's a difficult question, because a lot of women, you know, are proud of what they do, but somehow think someone's going to come along and tell them how great they are. And it often doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So how do we pick ourselves up and really get ourselves out there in a non-cringe way? That's the key to everything, I think, particularly in the British context.
Yeah. God, so talk us through a few examples about what you recommend in order to help people to do that.
Okay, so I don't always follow these myself, and I have learned a lot. I think the best one I learned, I think, was from an American influencer, a brand expert, was amplify other people 5 times before you amplify yourself. So that could be on LinkedIn or social media. It could be, you know, in a meeting where someone says something that gets passed over and you say, oh, what Shelley said was a really great point, thank you. You know, just to go back to that. And I think all of those tactics together are really helpful. And I suppose the generosity piece is something that's often been missing. You know, if you can be generous, even if it's a kind of slightly calculated generosity, I don't think it really matters where it comes from. It's the visible effects of that.
Yeah.
But I think our instinct so often at work is to be defensive and to put the drawbridge up around our work in case someone else steals our reputation or our, you know, I mean, God, I've lost count of how many times I've seen people sabotage a corporate endeavor just because of petty, you know, personal warfare. And, you know, we only have to look at politics to see that in action every day. So I think if we can bring generosity to our encounters and actually not think about how we become visible ourselves, but about amplifying other people, the rest of it will follow. I mean, that's the theory. I'm trying. I am quite selfish sometimes, so I do forget.
So the idea there would be that it's to take the edge off that feeling that you might be just bigging yourself up, and to make sure that people don't just feel like you're
Lifting all boats. You know, I suppose this is something that's been borrowed from the early feminist. And it's interesting how a lot of the things, so, you know, a lot of the things that 10 years ago or even 5 years ago we were talking about in workplaces to do with women, you know, equity for women, have now morphed into something much more general, in terms of, you know, amplifying and lifting all sorts of people from different backgrounds, from minority backgrounds, from, you know, who are coming to work from a place of not being at the center, you know, the workplace was not built for them. And I think it's great that we can, you know, move along with these arguments and not be stuck in the past. But I don't know, you might want to, but I think, you know, obviously in the modern workplace, we're all trying to amplify each other. We're all trying to amplify ourselves. It can be quite noisy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of noise. So that's the pitfall, I'd say.
So this is probably a good opportunity to talk about some other issues that you talk about in the book. And I think work-life balance is long been a subject that I've wrestled with. How realistic is it in the typical workplace to balance family commitments with career aspirations?
I think it's more realistic than it used to be. And that's not a wholehearted endorsement. I mean, balance is a tricky word, isn't it? It's probably, how would I describe it? It's not quite blending, but I think the boundaries are much more blurred because of tech and because of the pandemic. In knowledge work, we can do a lot of our work from home now in a way that was not the case before. So I suppose what my big hope for the future is that there's a lot more flexibility in terms of when we work as well as where. The kind of asynchronous work revolution is interesting to me. You know, you might want to get, I got up at 6:30 this morning and did 2 hours work because I want to knock off at 5 and go to yoga. So before the pandemic, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I would have had to be sitting on my seat here in central London until 6:30, 7, and then getting a crowded commuter train home. So that, I think the circumstances of the pandemic and what's come after have allowed a different conversation. And we can talk about how that conversation is rolling back with some of the return to office mandates. But that's such a short-sighted way to operate because you're explicitly excluding a lot of people who are great in your workforce but who don't want to come to a workplace 5 days a week. So I think that's that tussle, the work from home return to office tussle, is morphing into something much more interesting and complex. I don't know what you think.
I had a meeting yesterday morning with somebody who works for one of the large tech companies, Silicon Valley based, but he works in the UK. And although he isn't directly affected in quite such a severe way, he was talking about some of his friends and colleagues who are in the US. So this organization's CEO fully embraced remote, I think shifted some costs from the office and pushed people to fully remote, hired on that basis. Loads of people, particularly in the US, moved to other parts of the States. And now they've returned to a policy of 4 days in the office minimum. And that's just completely upending people's lives. And that, this is, for me, like the worst manifestation of it, because people make decisions about their lives to move to other places and they simply cannot move. So actually, really, what that is creative redundancy, essentially. Yeah. They're making people resign because they aren't able to do it. So that's like the worst case. I've got lots of friends with young kids and they've made decisions about their careers and the companies they've joined based on having a certain amount of flexibility, as well as made decisions about childcare costs, which are so expensive. I'm in North London and it's bloody expensive having childcare. So you make a decision and then suddenly you have to increase those childcare costs by 40%. And again, it's impacting people's lives. So I am firmly of the opinion that as much flexibility as possible is the right way to go. And ultimately, I think it will play out that the companies that offer that will succeed because they'll get the best people working for them. But to be honest, it comes back to that thing we were talking about earlier on, that without being able to clearly measure outcomes, which is what typically people say when they say we should have a flexible work policy. Well, it's okay, people can work flexibly because we can ensure that that we get the right outcomes. But unless you can measure what that or have a definition of what that means, then you're starting from a position of blindness.
No, I think you're right. And I maybe at some point, the idea of productivity and output or it will be moved over to what makes people happy, what is engagement, a more human focused. Because at the moment there are lots of things about productivity. Is it better in a hybrid or an in-office or remote situation? But as we, you know, can't really measure it properly, I mean, what is the point? Surely we measure how engaged the workforce is and how happy and well they're working. But I don't know. This all just seems to be too much for some of these CEOs. Yeah. I mean, I suppose what it goes really right back to at the most basic is that we as hardwired humans like to see people in front of us. You know, that goes right back to when we were living in small hunter-gatherer communities. And, you know, we have to work really hard to overcome those biases. And some people aren't really working hard at that at all.
Yeah. And the nature of a career in general is changing. I think we might have discussed this last time you were on this podcast, but I really like The 100-Year Life, the Andrew Scott and Linda Grattan book. I sort of talk about it all the time. And in many ways, it's kind of comforting that we might work longer, particularly if we are lucky enough to have the sabbaticals they talk about. I need one of those. Because, you know, it takes a little bit of pressure off this idea that you need to just build your pension up as much as possible because you're going to retire. But it does change also the nature of our lives, the fact that we will be working longer. But I was given optimism when I read about your idea of sort of late career blooms. So talk to me about that. Is it? I'm not sure if you called it a phenomenon or not, but certainly the idea that there's a positivity that can come later in your career when you re-embrace work. Where does it come from?
I think it is coming from longevity and people are happier for longer and well for longer. But I'd say it's an emerging trend. But it's, again, with so much with work, there's a whole kind of top piece of CEOs, executives, entrepreneurs, people who've got good pensions who are able to take a step back and maybe work part-time, maybe retrain, maybe go to America and go on one of these amazing courses that people like Chip Conley offer, kind of, you know, New Elders Academy or Harvard. You know, some of the big universities are doing the kind of next stage of your life courses, so third quarter courses for reinvention around purpose and meaning. But then below that, we've got the, you know, same old, crappy ageism, discrimination, people not being able to get jobs who want to get jobs in their 50s and 60s. So, you know, it's a slightly luxury item at the moment, but I'm really hoping that it will become much more mainstream. And I do think there are more companies and organizations thinking about the wisdom that comes, you know, the return on experience, ROE, that some people talk about. You know, there is a wisdom in having been in the workforce for a long time. Not everyone's wise, but, you know, you've probably seen it before. Like a lot of financial institutions keep people around who've been in the previous financial crisis because that stuff matters, actually, and institutional knowledge matters. And one of the big things that's lost, I think, when people are so focused on youth is that a spread of ages, while not the easiest team to manage, can be the most productive and creative. And I do really believe that. I am quite hopeful about this. And also there's lots of people, you know, demographically, there's lots of people in that bulge. The boomers are coming up to retirement age. I'm Gen X, which is a sort of slightly small and overlooked cohort. But, you know, I think it's exciting.
I think it is as well. Yeah, I like, and especially if there are learning opportunities made easier through technology. I am generally I don't know if I call myself a techno-optimist necessarily, but I feel pretty positive about the impact that AI could have. Clearly, it's going to have, yes, you know, there's always going to be people who are negatively affected, right? Some jobs are going to disappear because of AI, and unless the people who currently do them are able to be retrained and given a new purpose, then it's going to be really difficult for that cohort of people. But I generally feel pretty positive that technology and specifically AI can help us build new careers. So I found some of the stories you talked about very relatable, and I'm sure many other people do, particularly about colleagues. Every job you do, it's rare you go through your life without coming across people who you don't naturally bond with, naturally vibe with. So some of the kind of practical tips that you give around this stuff. I mean, managing difficult colleagues. How do you go about doing that? Where do you start?
So what I learned from writing this book that I wish I'd learned earlier, which is probably a key takeaway, is think about what you're bringing to the situation, not just, you know, our instinct is to say, oh my God, they're so unreasonable. They want this project by yesterday and da da da. And they're, you know, and their manner is so rude and they're, but why are you reacting in that way? What is it that, you know, your mother or your father or your childhood is bringing. And I think that could be quite a difficult thing. You know, sometimes when I talk about this with people, they're very unwilling to admit, you know, they people have traditionally seen work as sort of siloed off from the rest of our lives, as if we're kind of much better versions of ourselves when we go there. And that might be true because we probably behave better, but it isn't true that we're not taking all the, we're not dragging a massive suitcase of baggage with us to work. So I guess that would be my top tip, or the thing I'm trying to do is, you know, I've had, you know, I had a couple of bosses earlier in my career who I found so difficult. And it was only really when writing this book that I realized that I was trying to please them all the time. You know, that I was treating them as a critical parent. And because I was a very people-pleasing, hardworking teenager, you know, I did well by doing well. But if you're, if, you know, and often my best wasn't good enough for them because they were fundamentally very critical or and or didn't like me. And there's no getting around that. And so the harder you try, the harder you try. And I really worked myself into a hole and quite a miserable mental state.
Yeah.
So it was a real lesson, actually. You know, we're not, I'm not perfect. None of us are. But some, you know, it's only certain combinations that really spark each other off. So there could be some rude person in your team who you find actually quite funny and enjoy their directness, but someone else might find it intolerable.
What you just described there, I've become better at. I think early in my career, I used to take it as a personal affront when people were direct to rude. But I think that's a cultural thing as well.
It is.
Just didn't have much exposure outside of British working culture. I worked for a year in Germany, but that was a different experience because I was just learning the language. So I don't think I got the nuance. But it's only recently, I suppose the last sort of 5 to 10 years, is my exposure to different cultures has grown. I've actually come to enjoy seeing how different people communicate, and some cultures are just incredibly direct. And again, yeah, at first I was taken aback a little bit because we're, as a generalization, British, you know, we're kind of much more withdrawn and don't necessarily aren't as willing to say what we think straight away. But I do enjoy it now, actually. I feel I appreciate getting to the point much more quickly. That experience you had, do you think it could have been any different? Like when you were a teenager, do you think if you'd have being coached on it by somebody, you could have changed that experience? Or do you just think it had to be something you learned through experience?
I think I could have changed my relationship with my bosses more effectively. And although I've had a lot of therapy, you know, often when you're in therapy, you're not really thinking about those relationships necessarily. So sometimes coaching can be really helpful in working through a specific problem with someone. And I think coaching has become much more prevalent in the last 10 years, probably, or even 5 years. And people would engage a coach, for example, to go for a new job, or, you know, you might engage a coach for a particular problematic relationship to decide if you're going to stay or go. You know, can I live with this imperfect relationship with my boss because I really enjoy the other opportunities, or do I need to go? So it can be quite clarifying in terms of decision making, I think. I wish I'd known that earlier.
Yeah. I wonder if, I've not done any AI-based coaching, but there's certainly a lot of companies that are trying to integrate that. I wonder, have you had any exposure to that?
No, we should give that a go.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking some of those principles, I guess, could be shared. You know, if you're having a dialogue with with an AI, I don't see why that they couldn't at least be pointing some of these things out. It's not the same as having a human being who can empathize, but I bet it would work.
And it might take some of the heat, actually. AI might take some of the heat out of office dynamics.
Yeah.
So somebody did an AI summary. I did a talk at a literary festival. Somebody sent me an AI summary of my talk.
Oh, right.
They'd been recording it and then gave it chat to you. And it was really interesting. I thought, actually, that'd be fantastic. I mean, I realized that the big techs, you know, rolling this stuff out for meetings. But when you can see what you've actually said in black and white in a summary, maybe people's behaviour will get better because some shocking things go on in meetings, don't they?
Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, that's it. I think I do get sometimes people have those bots pop up on your Zoom meeting where they're just recording the meeting. Again, first time that happens, you think, oh, you know, I don't know about this. But actually, I think there's something positive in it. About sort of radical transparency is generally a good thing. So in fact, I think maybe this has gone a bit far, but I was listening to an interview with a tech leader the other day, and they make every single communication they have within the business transparent, but including performance reviews and one-to-ones, which I think is probably maybe a step too far. I think that's...
suits some people. I mean, it's interesting, but brutal. Mm.
Yeah, that whole Ray Dalio thing was pretty interesting and on the sort of the disturbing end, I would say, of company communications. Yeah, that AI thing is interesting. Actually, I'm gonna look into it. I think there's a couple of interesting applications of that. Actually, just slightly out of this conversation, but there was one which is training you to do interviews, so you can actually practice answers to your interview questions, and it will play back to you how they come across and how your facial expressions even come across to the reader. And I think I'm pretty sure I heard somebody which. Essentially, that you could train for that difficult conversation. He said, no, there's no reason why you couldn't. You say, play the role of a different difficult colleague. Here's a scenario, and sort of playing it back. And I can imagine that doing that preparation again, like you say, taking the sting out of it almost, just going through it once or twice.
I would be up for that. I think that's a really clever use of it.
Yeah.
Because people are so cack-handed in difficult conversations as well. I mean, I speak for myself here, but it's really hard.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I've definitely mucked up some conversations in the past, which you immediately regret afterwards. So, you've now written a book, and it's a big undertaking. Being somebody who's made writing your career, I guess it's a sort of natural evolution. But I mean, how do you evaluate your own personal and career growth? And do you look back on this particular experience as an important part of your journey, or the natural culmination of your journey?
I think it's a part of it. But I think the positive thing I take from the direction my career's taken latterly is that, I'm in my 50s and now. I've been a print journalist my whole career, but to pivot to audio and newsletters, which are much more intimate forms of communication with our readers and listeners, it goes straight to your inbox, it goes straight in your ear. So people feel that they know you in a very different way from when I was writing articles with my byline on the top.
Yeah.
There's less mediation, even when you're working for a global media brand, and I don't have any, I'm very grateful to the FT, because without the FT, I wouldn't be doing what I do. I have no doubt that I'm backed by this amazing operation. I have a fantastic producer. I have newsletter editors. I'm very lucky, but it's part of my journey within the FT. But it's an unusual journey because of the way legacy media has been. So there's an industry specific thing, but in a wider and personal way, I think it has opened a lot of doors for me, and it just makes you think differently. I feel more expansive. I meet a lot of very interesting people, and I find work endlessly fascinating. I'm sure you do too, because it's everything about being human. Yeah. And then money making, psychology, how we feel when we interact with other people. So much. It's got everything.
Yeah, podcasting is a unique medium. I mean, clearly, I don't have this sort of huge audience that I've heard other large podcasts who've talked about this subject, but you definitely feel a sense of intimacy with somebody because you're listening to them just in every situation in your life, in intimate situations. And I think the best podcasters as well, it comes across as very natural. And I think that's when you do get a sense of who someone is, rightly or wrongly, because look, you can only be yourself to a point when you're talking into a microphone with headphones in your ears, right? But what do you think is the future looks like for your career? Are you thinking much more intentionally about what you want from, say, the next 5 years or the next 10 years?
I think at the moment I'm seeing what's next because I'm really enjoying it. And I think it's really important to savor that moment because it doesn't last. I've been in enough jobs and I've done enough things, and I'm sure you have too, and the listeners have, to know that those moments are rare and you have to enjoy them. And then, we'll see what happens next. But I'm really heartened by the kind of late career blooming aspect of the future-proof career. So whatever comes next, I hope it's that. And I also have a really big, our lives ebb and flow at home. My children are young adults now, and that gives me a certain degree of freedom that I didn't have 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah. But it also, and with that comes a new burst of energy, essentially. So I feel, excited, actually. I'm less knackered than I was 10 years ago. And that's a big thing, actually.
It is.
Everyone's exhausted.
I feel you. I'm looking forward to that. Well, thank you very much for joining me again. And thank you for writing the book. I'm going to put links to it in the show notes. We'll speak again soon.
Ollie, lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much again to Isabel for joining me today. Really enjoyed that conversation. Please do pick up a copy of her book, link in the show notes, and get in touch with me if you'd like to hear more about any of the themes we discussed today. Thanks as ever for listening, and I'll see you here again soon.